I'd like to begin this panel. I think the last panel did a very good job of setting up some of the issues, and I copied some of the questions that were posted because I think they're actually particularly germane to this panel as well. I'll wait. But in this case, what we're trying to accomplish in this panel, that it was brought up in the last panel, that a lot of the issues about what kind of infrastructures, what kind of solutions are being proposed. And on this panel, we have really the major players in proposing new kinds of solutions to the identity space and developing infrastructures and actually be launching products and services that will shape the identity space in the very, very near future. And so we're very fortunate to have them talk briefly about what their approach is and what their thinking is. And then we can have some commentary. Jeremy Warren from the Department of Justice, to see the extent to which these solutions are something that would help protect security and at the same time privacy and civil liberties. So we can engage a lot of these questions on this panel. I'd like to start with Kim Cameron from Microsoft, and who's been one of the real thought leaders in this whole area. And he was the father of the notion of laws of identity, and Microsoft is coming out with a new product. It's called CardSpace. Is that correct?
That's it.
That's the trademark name. But it's been really very, very instrumental in getting people to think about creating this new meta system. So, Kim, could you start the discussion?
Sure. Well, thanks, first of all, for organizing this, John, and for your kind words earlier. Much too kind for me. Okay, so basically my role is as the chief architect of identity at Microsoft, and I'm responsible for a whole bunch of identity products. And a number of years ago, I have to admit, just between us as friends, that Passport was never my favorite technology. In fact, when I first went to Microsoft, they have this sort of initiation for architects, and you have to give a speech, you know, where everybody's booing you, just to prepare you for what it'll be like later in the organization. And so my speech was called Privacy, the Mad Cow Disease of the Computer Industry. With the subtitle was, And Microsoft is the Englishman. Anyway, so I believed very much that Passport was going to, under its own weight, transmogrify into something which was exclusively oriented for the Microsoft properties, as eventually happened. And began this work on what do we actually need as an identity system. And so I came to the same conclusions that we discussed in the last conference. Segregation of context, segregation of identifiers, reduction of disclosure, exactly the opposite of Passport in the sense of limiting the parties to an interaction to those who are justifiable, supporting multiple technologies and operators, and above all, in giant letters, interoperability. Now, we talk about user-centric and, you know, is it going too far? Well, you know, we have to go far for at least a few days, because the pendulum has to swing away from the area it was in. Users had been factored out of the equation. You had all these different back-end technologies with no users. No way for them to conceptualize their identities. No metaphors. No what I call reification, in the sense that there's a thing that stands for an abstract concept. And in keeping with the notion that there would be this blind evolution of technology leading us to more and more identities, was clear that passwords were themselves on their last legs. And finally, I had done a technology called MetaDirectory. I was very active in that with Craig Burton. And I guess one of my main learnings out of that is that amalgamation of information undermines security. The contextual separation that we have in the natural world actually increases security because, you know, you don't have this this single compartment in which everything is visible to everything else. So I developed this goal of an architecture that combines privacy, security, convenience. Yes, because the convenience factor is the one that will drive it. And basically, the notion would be to think without any constraints. Because until now, what we've done is we've said, oh, well, gee, the problem is so bad. And, you know, we can't change the desk. We can't do anything really significant because, you know, there are all those browsers out there and so on. And indeed, it's just a fantastically difficult problem because no one party can solve it. Microsoft can't solve it because we would just be often some one of our other Microsoft initiatives, as I'm sure Tony would be the first to point out, rightly so, if that were the case. It has to be solved by the industry, and even there it takes a tremendous amount of cooperation and rethinking. So that's really what the information card concept was about. It was finding ways to be able to visualize, reify information relationships so that we could manage multiple contextually distinct, non-linking identifiers on a very, very intuitive scale. And where in the back end you would have this connectivity to any kind of system running on any operating system or any computer architecture. So it was actually at one of the last conference held here that, you know, we were sitting in a room, and one of the goofy things I did was I was calling everything info cards. It was like, you know, once you've invented a screwdriver, everything's a screw. So, you know, there we were. Everything. I was saying, well, you know, you have the info cards, which are these visualizations, these reifications, and then you have the Microsoft info card system, which runs on Microsoft. And so nobody knew when I was talking about something interoperable, something that would be across the industry. Ben Laurie wrote, you know, actually posted some absolutely devilish remarks to this effect, all of which I had to agree with. So what that's resulted in is clearly distinguishing those names. So our implementation on which is shipping in Vista, and I would give a date except you'd all laugh, so I won't. It'll be shipping in Vista, so that's very soon now, real soon now. And it'll be going down level onto XP, so it'll get a very significant distribution very quickly. So the system that we're putting in place there is called Card Space. Now I know Jamie Lewis. Where's Jamie? Jamie said, "See that he's underwhelmed by the name Card Space. It's so, you know." Softly spoken. And that was, in fact, an idea, a conscious thing, because we really want to draw the attention to the information card, which some will abbreviate info card, as opposed to the card space implementation that we happen to put forward. So our friends at Higgins, you know, and at IBM and Novell and lots of other places are working on ensuring that the same concept or some superset of that concept is developed, you know, in across a whole bunch of different platforms and everything else. So that's my news, and I'm here. I would love to speak with anyone who wants more information about this. I believe it is the most significant technology shift in terms of user privacy possible. I would love to wade into some of the discussions that we had earlier, but I will spare you that for the time being.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, the next speaker is going to be Tony Nadelin from IBM. And IBM has taken a very interesting perspective in this whole industry in terms of looking at something called open identity, open security, and has very much embraced an open business model and interoperability. And using this as a new kind of business strategy that is quite remarkable in an industry. So, Tony.
So IBM's in a pretty unique position here. You know, we just about like everybody out there. So it's very hard for us to say no to things recently. So what's really happening here is we see this synergy around open collaboration, which really hasn't been, you know, going on very long as far as the identity and identity management space. And we believe this is key in coming up with agreeing upon common terms, common user experience, so that we can all draw from the same perspectives, so that we're not cross-talking against each other about what the terminologies mean, as far as you know, what a digital identity is, what an attribute is. In this way, we can help formulate the common user experience. One thing that we see missing here is the synergy between technology and law. Right, so we're great at doing technology. We can come up with technology. God, how many companies out there are producing identity technologies out there? But what are they driving for? What are the laws? What are the things that they're trying to solve out there? So this is one thing that has to come together is a synergy between law and the technology that we're building. Either that or we're coming up with technology and it may not agree with what the laws are doing, or the laws may not agree with what the technology that we're building. The other key aspect is interoperability. You know, so IBM has seen a lot of our customer requirements for interoperability, and we've done quite a bit of work with Microsoft and Kim on interoperability of standards. Okay, it's one thing to collaborate on the standards. The other thing is to make sure that we can get interoperability of those particular sets of standards out there. That is, being able to get them down to a particular profile that we know we can exchange data between each other, and that these things actually work. This is the only way that we're going to have a chance to reduce the number of identity systems out there today. You know, today we have a plethora of identity systems out there, yet we keep building these things and there's just, you know, no potential interop. You know, there may be potential hidden behind the covers of interoperability, but when you look at them on the surface, they're very hard to sit down and integrate these technologies together. So the other aspect is, as we start to build these identity systems out there, what are the privacy aspects of these user-centric systems? One is consent, right? About, you know, what you can release and other things. And the other aspects is on autonomy, right? To be able to say, you know, to be able to determine who I am or hide the aspects of who I actually am when I'm doing business. And I see some lack of synergy around those particular sets of areas today. You know, we're keen to jump on user-centric management, but there are some basic aspects of privacy that have to get solved in these user-centric areas. So what IBM saw was a chance to enhance all these, the open collaboration, the interop, the common terms, user experience. And so what we've done is put a lot of effort into working with the Eclipse Higgins project as far as being able to define an open source, an open environment for doing this identity collaboration work. So there's a lot of efforts going around that are what I would call outside the scope of public open source, and we'd like to see a lot of these things start to join together. What we don't like to see is a lot of proliferation of these open source efforts, right, that are going to be divergence, because this can only help but splinter the activities around open identity and trying to get this thing, get this motivation going on.
Great.
Johannes, you want to be next? And Johannes is a CEO of NetMesh, and he is a proponent of a lightweight identity.
Right, and if you don't mind, I get up because I speak much better.
Okay.
Spanish. So thanks, John, for having me, and of course, thank you everybody for coming. What I'd like to do, rather than talking about the gory details of one technology versus another, I thought I would want to explore with you why it matters. You know, why we are all here, because we believe that user-centric identity somehow matters, but why is that? And I'd like to propose that there is several reasons for that. As entrepreneurs, we, of course, see huge business opportunities. If we are right about all of this, then we will have billions and billions of user-centric identities sometime soon, and that makes us salivate, and that's why we're here. As engineers, of course, we see cool new technology, and that solves a whole lot of problems that have been around for a while, and that's also worth doing. And as security and privacy people, we believe that, of course, digital identity will disrupt various plans of various bad guys and make us all much safer. But I also like to suggest that there is something more profound behind that. And that's really what I'd like to talk about. Recently, I came across a book by John Markoff, which you might know, called What the Dormouse Said. And this book chronicles the history of Silicon Valley, mostly in the 60s. And it makes the rather convincing case that the personal computer, and with it the technology industry as we know it, was not created because of engineers who thought it was a cool idea. And it was also not created because some inventors and some investors and some business people thought some money was to be made. But it was created because of people like Doug Engelbart, who wanted to solve society's hard problems, none of which has to do much with technology in itself, by empowering individuals with a new set of electronic tools centered around the individual's use and creation of information. And it was this social goal that made the PC industry happen, because that goal was actually widely shared at that time among lots of people. And because of that goal, the PC industry was created and had all the great ramifications for everybody else. Now, some decades later, of course, technology is very different than back then, but I think there's a certain deja vu here that I feel every time I look at digital identity. The observation first is that the PC was not created because nobody had computers. At least the people who created the PC had access to computers. They did have access to mainframes, and the reason why they created it is because they didn't like that. Because somebody else ruled and set the rules about what you could do with that mainframe and how you could do it. You know, somebody else got in the way of your own creativity, of your own way of interacting with information, of your own way of dealing with this new medium as you saw fit. And so what we really had here was people who were really dissidents with the state of the art in computing at the time. They essentially objected to what one could call the landed gentry of computing, the people who had interjected themselves between the people wanting to use the computer and the actual computer. And they said the equivalent of, we rule the land here, and you can't do what you want to do here. We set the rules, and you have to go through us. And the reason why the PC was created was because it was a personal resource. And so now I think in digital identity, we are largely in the same situation today. We all already have many digital identities, billions of them. Our bank has one, our healthcare organization, our insurance company, our grocery store, and as it seems like all the world's digital market, all the world's direct marketeers. And the question, arises, why do we need another one? And I suggest to you that the reason we're at this conference is that we demand more digital identity, but not of that kind. We want a different one. The parallel that we see here is very striking. It's because we are the digital identity dissidents, essentially. Unlike 30 and 40 years ago, of course, our cause is not about the relationship to computers, but it is about the relationship to this global information and collaboration and commerce infrastructure we call the Internet. It's really about an alternate view of computing where there's no landed gentry in the middle, where we own our own identities, where we assert ourselves on the net the way we think is right, not because of somebody else thinks that. So we want a digital identity to represent us on the net that is an identity that's controlled by us, the people whose identity it is, after all, and not by the self-appointed gentry of identity providers who somehow think that without their blessing, we cannot possibly hope to participate in that global information infrastructure. And I don't think any of us believes that. I think we all are here to prove them wrong. Now, we are we, and we will. So this is why I think user-controlled digital identity is important. It's not because it solves technical problems. It's not because of beating the crooks, and it's not because of the money it will create and shift. But it is because it's essentially because user-controlled digital identity is the key ingredient to make the Internet, as big as it has become, human. And so I think pulling this off is difficult. And why is it difficult? Because it is difficult as every time you take power from one set of people and give it to others, in particular individual, individuals, it is difficult to pull this off. You know, the digital landed gentry is putting up a fight already. And they're fight, you know, they're fight because they say that they generally don't believe in self-empowerment of individuals. That's one thing. But the other part of it is because we threaten to cut them out of the picture. Right? Society will break down if we don't have a ruling identity class, they will say. Ever heard that? Yeah, we have heard that song before, not about digital identity, but about many, many things. And it has never been true. And so, you know, I can only try to imagine what obstacles Kim had at Microsoft when he first talked about putting control over somebody's identity in the hands of the people rather than in Microsoft's hands with Passport. You know, today, one sometimes gets the feeling that the laws, you know, means Kim, not Moses. So when a year and a half ago I started blogging about the idea that you could, you know, grab a URL of your own choosing, and we called that idea lid at the time, and you could essentially claim that URL anywhere on the net and declare this to be as your homestead, you know, from where you engage with the rest of the world, from which we conduct our business with the world in our own terms, just like Doc, you know, many others have predicted that would occur. A lot of the establishment, of course, ridiculed the idea and said it was very obviously unworkable. And the first thing that popped in my mind was, you know, just like with a PC. What did the establishment say about the PC? It was very obviously a toy that wasn't useful for anything particular. So, and you know, today, I think 18 months later, I think we have millions of individuals who actually do exactly that. If you cast the net a little bit wider, you know, some people call it edge commerce, or user-created content, or personal publishing, or self-expression. They have all the same trait in it, which is you claim a place on the net and say, this is me, and this is from where I engage the world. You know, some dismiss it as a fad for 14-year-olds in pajamas, but it isn't. There's too many separate lines, previously separate lines of thinking. They're all converging on that same kind of consistent worldview. And, you know, in my mind, there's, you know, today we only see the early scouting teams of this, but there will be waves of immigrants, essentially immigrants, that used to be dissidents and then become immigrants, who simply, you know, emigrate and just demand and then just act as if, and thus achieve first-class citizenship of cyberspace by basically creating themselves a homestead where they think they are going to start doing business from. And they will become essentially landed owners, you know, on the internet, just like all the other landed owners today, with equal rights and privileges. So one piece of thought for you, if you are a landowner on the internet today and your customers are not, you might want to think about what that means. In the real world, when the land ownership ceased to be a monopoly of the landed gentry, all sorts of really interesting things happened to the landed gentry, and very few people had a plan to adapt. I think the same thing will happen here. So, quick side note here, I'm glad to announce with some other people who are posting this on the mailing list as we speak that we take another step forward within the same vision. A number of us led by VeriSign and companies like Janrain back over there, and Cordance and Newstar and my company at Mesh are starting a new project within the Apache Software Foundation to essentially make the technologies to do that freely available and, you know, very easily usable, so that anybody can go out and say, you know, here I am, please deal with me, because I'm, you know, a landed owner on the internet as well. So hopefully this conference will be remembered as a key event where, as dissidents, you know, got together and where we put aside petty differences over protocols and, you know, gory little technical details, where we created a movement that is unifying, that is attracting people to the same vision, which is already happening, you know, to the point where finally we don't remember how to interact with the landed identity gentry anymore, because there simply hadn't been any need to interact with them for a long time. And then they will have faded out of their castles and we will not remember them. And that, I think, will be replaced by what I would call a thriving identity democracy. So I'm very much looking forward to work with all of you on that, and let's get to work.
Thank you very much. That was a magnificent vision. So, following that, Roger Sullivan, could you speak up on Liberty Alliance?
I am here.
You were referred to, Sefford and Brand made some mention to your work.
Yes, I am here representing Liberty Alliance and not Oracle Corporation, which is my day job most days. Although I will say that once we've made the decision about how all of this information is going to be stored, chances are it's going to be stored in one of those data repositories, and we are intently interested in hearing about the issues that are being raised at the conference. I am representing the Liberty Alliance. I am Oracle's board representative to Liberty. There are a number of other Liberty members in the room, including my colleague to the right here, Tony. Brett McDowell, sitting here in the front row, you can't miss him for the shine, is the director of the Liberty Alliance. We have Connor Cahill sitting next to him, who is one of the original architects. Peter Davis in the back of the room is also one of the early architects of Liberty. So if you've got technical questions about what Liberty is about and how it functions and so on, I'd point you to those guys. If you want to join Liberty, talk to me, talk to Brett. We'd be happy to have you. Liberty was founded in 2001, and since Kim mentioned it, and with all due respect and in the interest of full honesty and disclosure, it was somewhat of a backlash and reaction to Passport, largely driven by some enterprise customers and a couple of vendors. I hope we've moved beyond that, quite honestly. Liberty today is 150 members. It consists of both enterprise customers and vendors, and I think that that's a unique advantage that Liberty has, in that the enterprise customers say, vendors, if you build this, I will buy it, and that tends to get vendor attention. Liberty was founded with three organizing areas of interest. Business policy and privacy guidelines. Those were core to the organization from the very beginning. It was one of the, they were two original expert groups, that is business policy and the privacy, public policy expert group. The technology expert group, which most of you hear of, that's the one that spits out the specifications. And then another expert group that I am personally involved in is the what we call conformance, but it's really interoperability expert group. And I've had a couple of sidebar conversations during the course of the conference last night and then again this morning. To date, the interoperability efforts have been largely focused on Liberty-centric standards and SAML 2.0 as well. The industry, I hear, asking for a wider interoperability testing environment. There may be a role for Liberty to play there, or there may be a need for Liberty to collaborate with other people who are doing other kinds of interoperability studies. And I'm interested in hearing feedback on that as the chair of that group. The three principles with respect to the standards that Liberty has brought to market are, number one, user consent, right? The user has to choose or opt into this federated relationship. The user should have a choice of identity providers. That is, it should not be dictated to the user whom will be or what source will be their identity provider. The user should have a choice in that. And a slight modification to a comment earlier, there should be a decentralization of identity repositories. Identity repositories, from a business sense, don't make sense for a financial institution repository to be held at a competitor's financial institution identity store. That doesn't make sense, and it's not going to work in a business environment. So there needs to be this principle of separation of identity repositories. The earliest standards that came from Liberty were straightforward federation. That molded or melded into the SAML 2.0 standards. There has been work in Liberty on so-called web services federation. There has also been work elsewhere in the industry on web services federation. And Liberty, over the past 6 months, has put in, I will say, a tremendous amount of energy in trying to, as we refer to it, harmonize those two sets of specification, to use what makes sense and not be redundant, I think, to build on a point that Tony made, as well as Kim. So that really is an area of interest. And of late, we have focused on services. In particular, I think an appropriate service in this forum is the so-called people service that allows for individuals to invite other individuals into their circle of activity, be it sharing photos or private blogs or the kids' schedule of school activities or where the kids are going to be at a certain time, clearly private information that can be shared among different users on the net with very private information. What I'm interested in hearing about at this conference, if you care, is how does all of this stuff that we've been talking about and the activity that is now coming to the forefront of people, right, How does that affect what we, who happen to be enterprise developers, how does that affect us, and how does that affect organizations like Liberty? Consumers, if you think of a B2B2C kind of relationship, business to business to consumer, consumers really become an extension of the business. Here we hear a phenomenon where people and user centricity is pushing from the outside in, if you will, or maybe their point of view is pushing from the inside out, right? So where's that overlap, and how does that affect each of us as we build systems, as we try to build standards, as we try to keep our systems interoperable? So I hope we talk more about that over the next 2 days.
Thank you very much. Dick Hart, Skip. CEO Skip. I'll let him describe himself and his company.
My name's Dick Hart. I'm sure a number of you are happy. I'm not going to bore you with 500 slides on identity. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about was more around how do we get towards convergence around solving what the problem is. And I think the first problem is that I'm not sure that we all have agreement on what the problem is that we're all trying to solve. So I'm going to go over a little bit around what I think the problem is. I think one of the aspects around it is profile exchange. And I think that's actually one of the things that will drive adoption in the web space is profile exchange. In general, a website doesn't care around single sign-on so much as it is cares around how do they increase conversion of people registering on their site and getting more accurate and deeper information from the user. And they'd like to do much richer profile exchanges. I'd like to be able to share what my favorite books are. You know, and there's a lot of noise around this when the social networks first started up around faux files, so you could share, here's my list of friends, so that I didn't have to type them all again every time I went to a different social networking site. The next part of the problem, I think, is authentication. We have too many usernames and passwords on the internet, and username and password is a weak form of authentication. We want to move to stronger multi-factor forms of authentication, but as you move to multi-factor, you know, we're not all going to run around with, you know, 50 different multi-factor devices that we have. So we really need to move to where we can go and do strong authentication in one place and be able to move the results of that around on the internet. So essentially you can log on the internet instead of logging on to each application. The next part is authorization. How do we go and prove who we are and prove we have a particular role, prove we have a particular right? How do I prove that I'm over 21, prove that I'm part of Aeroplan, prove that I work at Skip, prove I'm a BC resident? You know, current technology, we can't go to a website we've never been to before and prove any of those types of things about ourselves. And then, of course, we have the privacy issue. How do we manage our privacy? How do we control who it is that's getting our information? And from a site point of view, particularly outside of the US, how do you prove that you got permission to use that data in a particular way? Because in Canada and Europe, just because you've got the data doesn't mean you can use the data. And then another point that I've thought of but hadn't articulated and was brought forward to in the panel earlier was recourse, which is, you know, you can sort of talk around all the rights of the citizen, but what are the responsibilities and how do you take that away? How do you, you need to know who the user is so that if they do something bad, you know, how do you go and you punish them? So if we just make it easy for me to go and prove I have an attribute, and if I could even give that to somebody else to prove they have the attribute, then the value of proving that attribute goes away. But how do you have recourse that if I'm evil out there that I lose rights? And these things map just not from a user point of view and a user app and a web point of view, but as we move more into Web 2.0 and a lot of enterprise technologies, how do we do this in the web services world, which is, you know, I think a lot of where the work from both Kim and what Roger was talking about started. So, you know, potentially we can all get some agreement around what that problem is, and I think that'd be a great topic for this conference. I have some ideas around what I think the characteristics of it need to be. So one of them, obviously, it needs to be privacy protecting. I think you need to be able to go and manage your identity in ways that you manage it online in the real world, where I have different personas. You know, I'm different whether I'm out with my friends, whether I'm with work colleagues, whether I'm with my family, whether I'm doing a financial transaction. So I think we may need to be able to compartmentalize our relationships. I think from a privacy protecting point of view, Kim that was on the board, on the panel earlier, made the comment, and I sat in the back and clapped all by myself, when he said that the value of identifiers was going to go to zero or low value, and I think that's what's going to happen. You know, my mother's maiden name didn't have any value 30 years ago. Why does it have value now? It shouldn't have any value. And so we need to move to a realm where we have equivalent of a digital driver's license as to how we prove we are as opposed to shared secrets. The next part of the characteristic, it clearly needs to be internet scale. It can't be something that just solves a problem for a small number of people that all agree to work together. It really needs to be able to operate on the whole internet. And since it's operating on the whole internet, another attribute around it is it needs to be community driven. It needs to be something where people can go and add and evolve it so that it solves their needs. They can go and put things into it that isn't centrally managed and centrally controlled. It needs to be easy to adopt, or it isn't even going to get started. So there needs to be a really low barrier to entry, and I think that's some of the challenges that some of the efforts in the past have had, is that it's been too heavy for people, which leads to what I think is the next characteristic. It needs to have a security gradient. You know, in the web wouldn't be the web today if everybody needed an SSL cert to start up a web server. But the web wouldn't be the web today if everything was in the clear and we didn't have secure websites. So I think there needs to be this gradient of being able to do really lightweight things like logging into Slashdot, and really things where the value of my identity being compromised is important to me, like looking at electronic health records. And then I'd like to conclude a little bit around, you know, what is user-centric. So I think there's a number of aspects of them, and one of them is that it's a consistent user experience for the user, that the site isn't setting the user experience, that the user is picking their tool to be able to manage their identity, and they get a consistent experience in it. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of research that talks around that user experience, and if it's in the user control, as to how that can solve one of the big challenges on the internet today, which is phishing. And another part is that the user's in the middle of moving around the data. So one, that has the advantage that the user has control around when it moves, but it also has some advantages around privacy. Then when the data does move, the user has given permission of doing it. But I think there's an aspect of it that's often overlooked, that by putting the user in the middle, you actually enable internet scale. And then if you don't put the user in the middle, it's very hard to scale. Because with the user in the middle, you can have people join the network ad hoc. They don't have to have a previous or set up any relationship with the other members that are working within the infrastructure. And that, I think, is an important attribute of many of the internet technologies we have out there. If you want to set up a website, you don't have to get any agreement with any of the other websites or browsers. If you want to be able to move email around, you don't have to coordinate with any of the other mail servers. And so at Skip, we're working on trying to foster and move this forward. Our business is that as we see this internet identity infrastructure emerging, is to sell solutions that help integrate existing IT with this. And so it's in our best interest to be driving adoption. To make that happen, we have a protocol that we're working with Novell and IBM and Red Hat and Oracle that's a DIX that I think sits between the lightweight stuff that Johannes works with and the heavier weight stuff that's typically come from the Liberty Alliance, and a number of people in the Web 2.0 world think stuff like the WSR is too heavy. So I think there needs to be something in the middle that sort of spreads that gap.
Great. Thank you very much. Our final panelist is Jeremy Warden, and he's from the Department of Justice, and he's involved in developing their technology strategy. Jeremy, you heard the various approaches to identity and infrastructure being built. Is this something that makes you feel better or worse? And how does it meet the government's perspective and security issues, national security issues, the things that they have to be done on your side?
Well, I'll start simple. I'll say better, but a lot of interesting questions involved. From DOJ's perspective, we have a few different perspectives, but first, let me say that I'm happy to be here. I met John a little while ago, and I'm happy to be invited to be on the panel, because otherwise I would have just been up here to set up the listening devices.
It's still being set up, so don't worry. It's not either or.
Yeah, my organization so far today, or at least somewhat related to my organization, has been called Mindless, Heartless, and Lazy. So I'm here to say that it's all true, and that's why I was sent down to speak to you, because I embody all of those things. And no, I'm not a lawyer. It's usually the first question I get when you say you work for DOJ. I'm not a lawyer. I'm the Deputy Chief Technology Officer at DOJ. So it's my job and my organization's job to take a look at technologies like those that surround identity management and get a sense of what that means for the department, both for the way that we run ourselves as a large organization, the way that we interact with our partners, and also in the mission that we have, the business that we do. So those three perspectives that we have on identity management, you know, the first, we're a large organization, it's 115,000 people. I have, by a rough count the other day, my set of credentials, physical credentials, I have more than two different ID cards that have some kind of digital capabilities that I have to use, on the order of 20 usernames and passwords, and about 10 other identities, and that's just to get access to various Department of Justice resources, buildings.
I think there's a number of panelists system. That would like to talk to you after this.
Scary. The government is a little bit behind the private sector organizations this size in terms of handling the mundane aspects of identity management. It's something that we're working on, and we work with the constraints of the government budgeting process and technology acquisition process to try to solve those, but we can certainly do a lot better. So everything I hear here from that perspective is obviously good. It'll help make our lives better and help us run our organization better. The next piece, and definitely more important, is we're a member of a bunch of communities, as everyone is here. We're a member of the law enforcement community, first and foremost. We're a member of the intelligence community. We're a member of the just general government-wide community. And that means that we have to interact with lots of other partners, lots of other organizations, and users from other organizations. So obviously, all the topics around federation are of tremendous importance to us. Just in our law enforcement community, we have 18,000 different organizations across the country. There are 18,000 different law enforcement organizations, about 900,000 different users. And so when you hear a lot of people talking about information sharing, what are we doing to prevent the next 9/11, just one aspect of the kind of problem that exists in trying to do effective information sharing on a national scale is how do you know that this other person that you want to share information with is who they say they are. And that aspect of identity is very, very difficult to solve for us. We're looking to federation. We're looking for a lot of interoperability because with 18,000 different folks, they're not all going to buy the same technology. It's something that we expect industry to lead on and that we're going to have to be able to follow a lot more aggressively than we have in our own organization. But there are a lot of things that are going on in that realm that are making it better. The main issue there is says who, and that's the way that I like to think about it. User-centric is great when you talk about user control, when it's user being able to assert more control over the way that their information is distributed and with whom they exchange information, a wonderful thing. Absolutely in favor of all that. I am a human being as well who's a user of the internet, and I want to have more control over how my information is used. But user-centricity without an understanding of authority, not necessarily government authority, but authority to assert facts that are true in the real world, I think is misguided and will not solve some of the really difficult problems that exist in identity management. You have to be able to know, when I say that I'm Jeremy Warren, am I really Jeremy Warren? And to illustrate this point, actually, I'm not Jeremy Warren. And the real Jeremy Warren, I'm just Jeremy's secretary. I'm here speaking on his behalf. I'm sorry for wasting your time. And he'll be in a sec to speak for the remainder of the time. Actually, you have no way of knowing if I'm lying or telling the truth.
Damn sure.
Well, there's a persistency across the conferences, you know. So I,
except for John, except for John, really, I don't think anybody else here has any way of knowing whether or not I really am Jeremy Warren. And if it's one thing if I'm wasting your time sitting here and speaking a little bit, it's another thing if you're trying to engage in some kind of transaction with me, whether
you're still fascinating, you know.
The other day I went on Craigslist to buy Red Sox tickets because even though I live in D.C. now, I lived for the previous 12 years in Boston and I'm a diehard Red Sox fan, so didn't want to waste the opportunity to buy tickets. And of course, the one thing I was worried about going on Craigslist is if I'm showing up to some place with $150 in cash to try to get tickets, I want to make sure that the person on the other side is actually, you know, someone with a real identity that, that I can have some assurances to. And in the end, Craigslist does nothing for me. Nothing really digital does anything for me in that regard. It's the cell phone number and the fact that we met at an actual place of business were the only clues that I had that, I know, to maybe tie back to a real identity. So it's very important the way that both in the law enforcement community and really if you think about it in the way that all of us interact with the rest of the internet and folks who are enabled through the internet, having some way to tie back to real world identities is necessary to do your business. Otherwise, you're really just on chat rooms discussing, you know, discussing things of no import. If you're doing anything of real import, eventually you want to tie back to reality. You want to know who it is that you're dealing with for one reason or another. And it might not necessarily be the same aspects of the identity that you care about, but some aspect of the real world identity you're going to want to get back to in almost all circumstances. So that ties me into, I guess, the last aspect from the DOJ's perspective, and probably one that you guys are more familiar with, which is the law enforcement and DOJ as a law enforcement agency and attacking our mission of law enforcement. With that regard, identity management is great. The key thing for us is that at certain points we need to, and I think that you want us to, be able to get back to the real-world identities in the situations where we're trying to investigate crime or prosecute offenders. It's not a question of if, it's the question of when. And I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a public policy person, I'm not someone who can speak on behalf of the department in terms of the procedures that are in place or when people get access and when the department gets access to that identity information. I absolutely agree that there need to be strong safeguards in place. There need to be, I think they were called control points or access points where humans can jump in. And our society needs to have a vigorous debate about under what circumstances organizations like mine do get access to that real-world identity information. But I hope that there's nobody here who believes that there aren't times when DOJ and other government agencies should get access to real-world identity information. So I think all these technologies need to keep in mind that there's value in that, and that having some kind of traceability, if not, you want to be able to preserve privacy while still being able to have some kind of traceability so that in those circumstances where the burden is met, you can get access to that information. So to me, that's it's an issue more of ownership in society making those rules and being able to have users exert more of our own ownership of information through our government rather than just allowing government to be clumsy. And I think the lazy was the term used before, and I completely agree. Good law enforcement does not need the kinds of clumsy access to identity information that we often hear about today. And law enforcement will have to continue to get better at the way that we're able to actually access the identity information, so it's not clumsy, so it doesn't create harm for those who, for whom we don't not want that information. But anyone who's ever had a search warrant come and be executed when it was not actually for you and it was meant for somebody else by the same name, or if you've been let onto been kept from getting onto a plane because somebody else with a similar name was on a no-fly list. I think that that aspect of identity management is something that we'd all want to be able to do better, to actually be able to figure out who is who. It's one other comment that I wanted to make before really opening this up is there was some talk before about prevention of linking, the lack of correlation handles, I think was one term somebody used. The way that I read the technology landscape and the way that things are going, it's gone. I mean, the idea that you'll be able to exchange identity in a way that will prevent linking, you'll be able to eliminate correlation handles, I don't think that's likely. There are too many ways that you can get back and ascertain some kind of identity. Yeah. And for the folks who are willing to invest the resources to do it, it's possible. So I think the more important question is not how do you do this while preventing through technology this kind of correlation and linking. The more important point is how does society set rules for that correlation and linking so it's only done in the situations that we want it to be done, and then it's only used in a way that we want it to be used? I don't think there's a technology solution to that part of the problem right now, not one that I see at least.
I can't help but asking about the momentum towards a federal or national ID card and what's gone on in Europe and sort of what the posture is of the administration, the government, or DOJ in this perspective. I mean, isn't the whole idea of having an authenticating party that has authority and force, I mean, is there going to be a default to do something as sort of Uber, or is it going to be contextual? Is it going to bake Kim's laws? Or where do you see things going in that perspective?
Again, I'm not a public policy person. I really can't speak on behalf of the department on
just
those
your observations. I'm just taking off your hat. You're not Jeremy. You're someone else.
So my observations
just between
on
between friends what? Here. Just you know, it's just off the record for everything. Right, right. Being broadcast to the world, but anyway.
I worry about this kind of evolution happening clumsily. Mm. I really do worry about that. I see it happening very clumsily now, and I think that it's not the technology that's driving that problem. I think that it's the lack of the public policy that's making that happen. We hear a lot of very uninformed debating going on around these kinds of issues in the places where we need to have a lot more informed debate of these issues. And so
so there's not an appreciation within the policymaking community of the nuance of the issues or the technology alternatives, and that's they sort of default to a more simplistic model. Is that fair?
I fear that without a better understanding of the issues, that the default will be to try to go back to a simpler model. I think there'll be a lot of pushback from that, and I think technology will help keep that from happening. I don't think national ID card is necessarily something that that is destined to happen. But I do think that a solution that has the appropriate amount of authority built into identification so that you can get on a plane and the person allowing you on the plane can know that when you say you're Jeremy Warren, you actually are Jeremy Warren. For me to be able to do my job, if you say that you are Sheriff John Smith from Twin Forks Police Department and you want information about the serial burglaries in your area that other folks have been investigating, I need to be able to know that you are not just John Smith, but you're Sheriff John Smith, and you're still Sheriff John Smith. So a lot of these kinds of questions are going to have to be solved. Otherwise, the intense pressure to actually come up with solutions here will lead to bad solutions rather than good ones.
I was just looking at some of the questions being posted, and it resonates with a question that I had that I'd like to ask all the panelists. And it's something that's come up. Having worked with this group and the Identity Gang for a year and a half, I mean, one of the extraordinary things that I find is that you have this effort to do something that's open and interoperable. And it is sort of, it's being directed not by government policy, but in a sense of a public good, in some sense, and what really works. And so when you take that, and to what the question that I'd like to put for you is what do you think is your biggest issue in making that happen? I mean, I think there's enormous progress being made. I think that the level of cooperation is extraordinary. And I think there's an agreement among this panel that you really do have to have multiple parties. It can't get balkanized. I mean, if it gets balkanized, then it's not the acceptance, then it's not going to work. So in terms of the progress that you've seen to date, what do you see needs to be done? Could you really sort of comment on what the big issue is into really getting something that is widely adopted and interoperable and open? Or maybe that's not the right question. No takers?
Do you have to have all three?
You have to have them. Yeah.
You have to have.
And you, I mean, did you? And you see that happening? I mean, do you really? I mean, this is and to me, it's quite an extraordinary event to see that this. I mean, the different parties coming together and agreeing to things that you know 3 years ago would not have been envisioned.
Yeah, you can be interoperable certainly without being open.
Right.
Right. You can have your own rules. One could have their own rules for privacy. That don't necessarily agree with another's rule for privacy. Maybe they're more strict or less strict than another. Another may say, oh, you don't have to go to that degree. I think Dick talked about the degrees of security, the granularity or the thermometer of security. Well, maybe my security doesn't require that much. So, yes, you can have interoperability, yes, you can have privacy, but I don't know that everyone is going to agree on what is the privacy solution. And then open systems have a lot to do with various business models. I think we all agree that open systems are good and should be contributed to, but there also is a value add, very pragmatically, from particular value add that a vendor may bring to the table. So it's not a, yeah, we're going to get there and the date is going to be 6 months and 2 days from now.
Seems like a good date, though.
Kim, you want to do this Monday?
Goals are good.
Well, I would say that, you know, we've made a tremendous amount of progress talking with each other and coming to common conclusions, not only in the traditional industry, you know, but also more broadly, reaching, you know, with other communities, people who think about this type of thing. And it is an informed, you know, we're trying to build a platform together. So it's not a, people are always talking about, well, the identity system should be like this.
Right.
Well, I don't buy that. It should be a platform that you can use as you see fit. And I think that, you know, as an industry, but not just the sort of, what can I say, you know, sort of traditional large companies or something, but also, you know, really going down into grassroots and bottoms up and, you know, startups and so on. We're all really excited about this. So that's phase one. Okay. Now there's, the next phase is getting what we call the relying parties. So, you know, that's getting the Amazons and the, you know, eBays and the Googles and all these guys, and getting the WordPresses and the, you know, blogging software of different kinds and so on. So, you know, that's the next phase, and we're all working on that, I think.
But just to build on that a little bit, because, I mean, I talked to Roger and I had a lunch, and we talked about this whole idea of some of the relying parties having to be receptive to this new model of user-centricity and having control over their information is a huge shift. And that information should be free, reputation should be free, and you take it with you, and you're the control point. I mean, that hits business models across the board.
Okay, but don't forget, it's just a platform.
Yeah, right.
The relying parties can use it in whatever way they want.
Right.
We can't sort of...
Really?
Well, you know, they can. And so all we can do is create a situation in which the things that we believe are the social good can compete and come to the front. Now, and I believe that's what this platform is. But, for example, I would expect that in the first day of the identity meta system, you know, the day after, you know, the Garden of Eden or whatever, there would be probably all of the identity providers will all give out their own information cards just as they do now. And so what you'll have is a new technology which is safer at a cryptographic level and at a user experience level, but which doesn't essentially on day one change the model. But now it will be possible for the model to change, whereas today it isn't. Once it's possible for the model to change, somebody like Tony or somebody, or, you know, Johannes maybe, is going to say, they're going to be smart enough to take advantage of that possibility. And so that's what I think we all have to look forward to, is not some kind of a one-day change in this.
I want to jump in here a little bit, because I'm being asked a question all the time, and it's sort of an undercurrent here around here. So how is this going to shake out all, right? From where we are, how is this going to evolve? And I think there's only three realistic scenarios, one of which is that one particular approach of the many approaches that are being proposed is just going to take over the world, right? You know, HTTP took over the world in a way. So this was one scenario. You can agree and disagree on what the likelihoods of those are, but I think the scenarios exist. Number two is nothing will happen, which is, you know, everybody keeps doing whatever they're doing, and we are in the situation that Warren just talked about, that we just have way too many of those identities, none of which is managed particularly well. And the third one is, I think, what many of us are trying to work on, which is have a sort of pluralistic environment where the pieces fit, and we can actually all build different parts of one overarching architecture. And when I say architecture, I mean it a little bit more broadly than I think Kim means it. There's a technology part to this, but in my mind, that's not the problem, really. We can do that. We know how to build adapters. There's a much larger architecture that we put in place. For example, consistency towards the user. It's completely impossible, right, that what the user sees is different depending on what the protocol is underneath. It will never get adopted. But also the ability for people to plug in with their own innovations. You know, if we basically freeze whatever we freeze, then innovation will stop. Nothing will happen. People will innovate outside of the system. And so people have to be able to plug in with new innovations, with new business models. And, you know, if we as technologists get our things right, then this will be possible. And I think, you know, whatever we do as technologists where people cannot plug in with whatever they came up with, that it's better than we came up with, we will all fail.
That's great. Anyone want to respond to that?
Well, one last thing, which is distribution, distribution, distribution. You know, to get something out there to bootstrap. And, you know, I'll certainly play my role in that. On a bad day, I fear it's pollution, not distribution. But, you know, we have to, I think in this case, the discussion has been wide enough that I feel, you know, very good about what will be distributed. But there are many other parties here who can distribute. So, you know, together we have to distribute into our products, get the whole thing so that everything is just sitting there. And then it's the user experience. So now the question comes down to, okay, is this thing cool? Is it fun to use? Is it better than using passwords? Well, you know, I get really mad now when I have to enter a password. When I came to your site and had to put in a password, tears rolled down my cheeks. You know, the general user experience is when you give them a better system, they love it.
Well, I mean, to that, before we open it up, I'd like to ask a question that is the most popular question that's been there for quite some time, and I think it ties into this because people are trying to conceptualize what it'd be like, and that isn't an information card really the digital equivalent of the cards I have in my wallet, or are they in fact pointers to central identity stores that are involved in real time in my transactions, and what's the experience of like it? What's the metaphor you're building on, and how does it work? And if you, I mean, I think it's important to sort of address that question and clarify it.
Okay.
And there are going to be demos, I should say. I mean, that's probably the best way.
Yeah, the demo is the best way.
Right.
Okay, I have to explain that when we say identity provider, and this applies to, I think, all of us in the room who are working technically, we mean something that is able to make claims about someone. And that's all it is. So one party making claims about another party. Now, where does that, we call it an identity provider. Where does the identity provider live? Well, it lives somewhere. So, we say in the cloud. So does the cloud mean in a glass house, in a centralized place? Well, in the case of something like Visa, yes. Does the cloud could equally mean in my own house. I mean, I think there are cloudies, homies, and workies, and the place where you would put your identity provider would probably depend on which type you are. So the cloud could include your dongle. The cloud could include your iPod. And your identity provider could be in any, and you could have different identity providers in different places. So I think I would probably leave my Visa identity provider at my bank. They would probably want to do that before they'll give me an assertion. So, yes, the information card doesn't put information, as paradoxical as it is, on your device. It just has metadata that says, okay, to go and get information, go here or there or wherever. But that here, there, or wherever could include your device if you want. So if you want one something like that, you stick one in. If you'd rather have it on your iPod, you have it there, or you keep it in the cloud. So that's why it comes back to this is a platform, not a matter of ramming some solution down people's throats. The basic self-asserted, somebody was making the point earlier, self-asserted identities aren't interesting. For heaven's sakes, 99.9% of the identities used on the web are self-asserting, and not all of that is bad. What? I forgot a nine?
Thank you for saying that, because okay. That is, I think it's true, and it's often that said in places like this.
It drives me mad. Like, sure, we all want to move forward, but, you know, what are we going to do? You some kind of a wormhole to get there? I mean, we have to go, you know, we have to use conventional, like, stay under the speed of light for a while. So what that means is taking this vast network based on self-asserting identity and allow it to migrate by giving it a platform where it can do more and better things, but not expecting it all to suddenly just, you know, implode into another dimension.
Okay, well, why don't we take some questions from the floor? We had hands? No hand? Ah, yes. Did you go to the mic?
Hello? I'm going to pretend to ask a naive question, but I really mean to...
Could you identify yourself?
My name is Ariel Gofang. I'm from Israel, and I'm one of the technology companies developing solutions for the identity market. I'm interested to understand why it's so important to Microsoft or IBM or Liberty Oracle to own the platform rather than completely open it to each other.
And so, from IBM's perspective, that's not our intent, right? So I think as John said originally, our intent is to have this system open. That's why we went off and joined an already existing project in Eclipse. We didn't start our new, we could have gone off and started a brand new project, done our own thing and tried to own it. We didn't, okay? We saw some value in what was already going on in the open source space in the Eclipse to include the tooling, the user experience, et cetera, and have joined this. I think Microsoft has come along and has helped us in this particular effort, right? They haven't hindered us, okay? They've been giving us information that we need to continue this effort in developing this open source effort, okay? So we've been very open in working with people that own some of this technology to try to get that information and get it out in the open domain with open IP, that is making sure that there are no encumbrances on this set of technology that we make open.
Yeah, I just want to point out, since unfortunately, no, I won't say that. We have our own way of participating and trying to deliver great software and so on. But I think we can do that and be totally collaborative. And I think that's what this relationship that we've developed here in the identity world is about. So we have no desire to control the platform. You can't control the platform. It's a stupid idea. Identity is to reach out to someone else. You already know your own identity. So there is no ability to control the identity platform. So that's my take on it.
Can I disagree with that? I think it is true that so everybody on this panel and lots of people in the audience and all around have been very, very good at making this as open and as collaborative. And, you know, and Kim gets the special kudos because from his perspective, working for the company that he does work for, that must be much harder than for any of us. However, if you're putting on your Machiavellian hat, there's a zillion ways you can drive this proprietary. And the jury is out and will be out for the next 5 to 10 years to know where we come down on. So you know, we all have a shared goal here, but that doesn't mean we'll achieve it.
I always succeed.
Well, that's very reassuring.
Yeah, right. No, but I mean, look, it's not just a goal. It's a matter, it's visible, it's translucent. I won't say transparent because then you can't see anything. But everything that everybody is doing is transparent. And for the first time, this is so important because, you know, in the past, everybody who had a system sort of just, you know, you saw what was in that system. There was no way to actually visualize outside the system. So this actually goes way beyond identity in the sense that you're able to get visibility between systems, you know, within systems.
Well, I'd like to pick up on Johannes' point. I mean, I think there's a,
looking forward, there is a potential, a danger for certain power laws to assert themselves. And Dick brought up the point of recourse. I mean, and so I remember the cable industry was coming in, and that was going to have a public access, it would be open, and then look where it is now. And I mean, is the identity industry, is it brokers going to have the same thing? Are you going to get a concentration? Are you going to get lock-ins? And this gets back to the architectural points that Stefan brought up earlier, I think.
Look at Facebook. I mean, that horrible thing of people checking, you know, the reputations of students by going through the Facebook, and if you can imagine this, not hiring somebody because he stuffed cigars with marijuana and enjoyed shooting people. I thought he sounded very interesting. But anyway.
Is this how Microsoft does it? I mean, is this the
well, don't,
part
you know,
of the
I hope I hope my Facebook thing doesn't, no. I mean, this comes to the question of, I mean, this is, I have kids that age. You know, I know what they're like, and it's like the micro-celebrity thing, right? And people like to posture and be funny and so on as well. And maybe they also have a few bad habits, but you know, one grows out of those things, I hope. The main point is stealing the information that was released in a context associated with the university and a context which was ostensibly it could only be other people of your age group from the university, and then stealing that and using that in these other activities. And so what my proposal here, the way it relates to this, is that I think once the platform is there, and you now can have ways of doing this so that there is no danger and revelation of this identity, that it's going to clobber the heavy-handed, stupid, you know, unthought-about mechanisms that are currently in use.
Well, if I can build on that point, I mean, what I see is an opportunity to have a plurality of approaches and competitions in the different governance mechanism. And from the point of view of the Berkman Center and where law and technology come together, can you have different governance mechanisms? And you're going to have a lot of innovation and competition along those dimensions. And you see something like that happen. So then people can self-select and decide what worlds they want to live in under what conditions. And that, I think, creates enormous opportunity. I mean, I think there's a social good and a commercial good that comes out of that. But, you know, there are those technical questions, the extent to which that can be co-opted or coerced. So how do you ensure that that is the case?
Well, I certainly agree that the undercurrent of the conference that we have to be vigilant is important.
Okay. Yes.
Microphone.
Yeah, you're going to get a microphone. Oh, okay, sir.
I wanted to pick up on the cable analogy, because there's no doubt about it that a cable is a natural monopoly granted by the city that runs down the street, and the same is true of the telephone lines. That's also another natural monopoly that runs down the street. Now, the Internet is not inherently a natural monopoly. However, as I understand it, there's laws there's bills in Congress now to change that to where. So that's just something I want to put into the back of people's minds that had never occurred to me before, the connection between the current bills in the Congress about the use of the Internet and the possibility that we would wind up having not a natural monopoly, but an established legal monopoly there.
And I think if Rebecca McKinnon in the back here was speaking up, I think she would probably say, you know, there will be a monopoly. Let's just not think U.S. for a second. Think some other countries that are a little bit less liberal than the U.S. is, you know. And it's entirely possible that people will require you to provide the equivalent of the national user ID for some country at pretty much anything in any country. And, you know, what we do here is global in nature. And if we solve the problem right for the U.S. and half right for the European Union, and we solve it the wrong way for the rest of the world, we still have lost.
Okay, yeah.
I want to follow up on a couple things people said about knowing your identity, self-asserted identity, and the question about national ID, and preface it by saying the example that most people use about the need for ID is getting on an airplane. You actually don't need an ID to get on an airplane. If you don't have an ID, you become a selectee and you have to be screened more carefully. The Gilmore versus Gonzalez case got the secret directive, which explains this. So my question really is, can you imagine, and how do you deal with situations where asking for identity is to really drop a presumption that there's certain rights and certain activities, I would argue voting, Gilmore argues, travel, that are so fundamental that you shouldn't have to prove an identity, and that the identity is in fact, the process of proving identity is in fact a way of depriving the rights. This is an issue I worked on at the Berkman Center a long time ago and now follow up on under the rubric sort of a personhood.
I would just suggest that there are situations where you'd want to prove some aspect of your identity. Certainly, there are situations where I would want some aspect of your identity to be proved, to be put into a communal risk situation with you. It doesn't necessarily need to be your name or your social security number or something like that, but you know, when you go to make a credit transaction, you want to know that you're actually the person who's supposed to be making that credit transaction on that account. When you get onto a plane, you want to be able to know that to some degree that there isn't a known risk of to everybody else. It doesn't necessarily need your name to be known, but some aspect of those are always tied to identity. So it depends on the situation. I think that technology can make this a whole lot more simple because we have such sloppy ways nowadays of gathering identity information. It's please let me see your driver's license and let me connect the information on your driver's license back to all the other information that I might have to try to put together just to answer the simple question of, is it safe for you to get onto this plane? Not such a simple question, but do I know that it's unsafe for you to get onto this plane? And another, a much simpler example is, are you 21? Are you old enough to get into this bar? You want to be able to prove that aspect of your identity without necessarily having to expose all the information about who you are, where you live, and so forth. So I think that technology could allow a much more fine-grained access to identity-related information that you'd want to be able to prove to get access to certain things.
Wait, can I follow up on that? What about the DOJ or the government generally? If you had the default be that you had anonymity, but authenticated anonymity, that was contextualized. And that would be then the way it would be done. So you would have different, and this is very much into the thinking of the info cards or whatever you want to call it. But that is where you start, and so that is that something that you think would have legs, or would that be very difficult to get across to your constituencies and law enforcement, et cetera?
Well, I guess it's a question of how you define authenticated anonymity, which to some extent is an oxymoron. I mean, if
no, you could have a third party authenticate you're over 21, and it could be an accepted party, or you could have a third party certify some other attributes of you, but you don't have to know where you live, all the other stuff,
and so
the linkability stuff could be taken out. And it'd be highly contextualized. And this is what this technology enables. And it's an important point to bring in to when you start thinking about policy and law, because that's a huge shift.
I think that's what I'm suggesting is the good direction to go in, that technology will allow you to I call that a piece of the identity. The fact that you're over 21 is a piece of your identity, hopefully a true piece of your identity. And if you that's really the only information that the person at the club needs, that should be the only information that they get
that's
from
right.
you.
That's
and I think technology will enable that.
There's also to go further in that vein, I'm curious what people would think about schemes where you're not actually asserting your identity, you're asserting what your identity is not. So it would be possible to imagine crypto schemes where information about who I am is used to determine that I'm not on a list without revealing who I am at all. So the only response you would get back is, this person is on a list. Well, what does that do? First of all, that makes the list thing something which is now translucent. We can see the list. If we can see the list and we can find out we're on it, then if we're not supposed to be on the list, we can find out why not. But at the same time, we've protected the privacy of the person, using that system. So this is what I always wonder. why do we want these mechanisms that create this uncompartmentalized honeypot of stuff that is going to attract attack? I mean, to me, it's psychotic. I don't understand it. I've worked in the security side of things for, you know, a long time, a few years, and the more you put together in one compartment and make available, you know, to lots of outside systems, the more you're creating an inevitable attack vector. Why are we doing these things? I don't know. I'm going to go to sleep now.
Wait, some other questions here.
Yes. Can I just, my question was actually the opposite of what people answered. My question was, are there circumstances where a right is so fundamental that you cannot or you should not have to?
But I was going to ask you, are you then bothered by something where you wouldn't prove your identity, but you would prove what your identity wasn't? Is that also an infringement? I'm not a lawyer. I don't understand these things.
Well, I would use the example of voting, a right which is absolutely fundamental, which you should be able to do and assert unless there's some probable cause standard to question who you are. Because if you always have to do the identity step first, then any fundamental rights voting from being a person just sort of disappear. Sure.
Well, you know, it boils down to what exactly you mean when you say who you are. Right, and I think everybody in this room has a slightly different definition of what that means. For example, I might just want to prove that I'm the same guy who visited the same website a week ago. Does that prove who I am? It only proves that I'm the same guy as somebody who was there last, you know, week. But if I can prove this, I can prove all sorts of other interesting things. And you can grow them from that. What you probably meant is proof where I reside and, you know, think attributes like that. But many of those attributes are not necessary for many, many scenarios.
Ben?
Hi. I'm Ben from MIT. I like to needle with this question. I've needled this question into you guys since February, but since you're all lined up here, what do you mean by the word interoperability? Here's what I mean by the word interoperability. I can use Firefox or Safari or Mozilla or IE to access this website that's up here. Can I use CardSpace to access an OpenID server? Can I use my LID identity to access an InfoCard compliant server?
Well, okay. Where did that guy come from anyway?
You're time to turn it around, Kim. You're
making... No, I mean...
Did you end your nap now?
I think that what we mean... Okay, I think that systems like LID are, you know, very basic systems for use in identifying people, say in weblog applications and things like that, and they're great at it. Now, do they have all of the capabilities of the systems, like the banking systems and so on, that you would want to access? Probably not. So I don't think you can say that every system, you know, that you can use every system to access every application. But something like the InfoCard system, if you, you know, the way I'm here, I'm talking about it as an industry technology, not as a product that I'm working on. It can be the superset of the other systems because, you know, it's got, you can plug in all of these crypto and identity stuff underneath it. So in that sense, you could go from an InfoCard system, there could be an InfoCard. I'm going to write one, for heaven's sakes, just so that this becomes perfectly clear. You can have an InfoCard identity provider that does LID.
Is that on the record?
What?
Is that on the record?
That's on the record. So, so what I'm saying there is interoperability is that, you know, I believe... I'm talking about at the level of people who will work for, you know, for example, things like WS Trust, which allow any token format, any security technology to go, you know, to be to be handled together. So those things are obvious. They're no-brainers. Then you have the simpler protocols, and I think they can be wrapped in the more complex protocols, but the opposite isn't true.
Tony, do you want to comment on that? No.
He's smart. Did I do all right? Did I explain it more?
No,
right.
So there is a difference between, you know, what goes across the wire. So in your browser case, you know, I may be using HTTP, but if I'm an Opera browser on my cell phone, I'm not going to get the same functionality that I get in an IE browser, right? IE browser may have plugins that Opera doesn't support. So are they still interoperable? So it all comes down to what applications or what functionality are you trying to get to? Okay, so you have to come to agreement on some basic sets of wire formats that can be interchanged, and then you can start to look at, gee, what applications am I going to support based upon those wire formats that go across?
That's good.
You know, if you look at your browser, they all support FTP, they all support HTTP, they all support HTTPS, right? And it's really, as these guys have talked about, there needs to be some convergence around a set of protocols. So, and I think it's really important, because a solution that just solves, gets you single sign-on and works with 5 of your 100 sites you go to isn't really helping the users. You really need something that works with the long tail of the sites as well. And, you know, hopefully we get there, and hopefully we're all going to work together to get some convergence. But that's what I mean by interop, that it works in the low-end places. It's easy to adopt. Someone just grabs some open source code, drop it in. But it also will work over on a heavy bank, because you use the same browser whether you're doing online banking or you're logging into Slashdot.
Yeah. On the same, Adrian Gropper, Met Commons, on the same topic, I find it very hard to, working with, say, Liberty Alliance to understand InfoCard, because they don't actually address, or for that matter, Higgins, they don't address each other's issues. This convergence that we're talking about, is it going to happen in the marketplace, or is it going to happen in the bodies that are developing these?
I'm going to invite everybody over to my house for beer, and we'll figure it out.
Yeah, they don't understand each other's issues yet, right? I detected a couple of snickers in the room when I mentioned WSF, the Liberty Standard, opposed to WS Star, right? Truth be told, WSF came first, right? Okay. All right, here we go.
Good, but now I get to watch it.
The point is, my point is simply that the marketplace said, and read marketplace to be enterprise customers, you guys need to get together and figure it out. And you need to make our lives less complicated than your lives are, than you're making my life right now. And that kind of motivation drives the vendors around the table to say, all right, how are we going to figure this out? How are we going to make these two things work together? How are we going to rationalize the two environments? And the same thing will happen with InfoCard. Exactly the same thing will happen. As Kim said, it will have mass in the industry. And those of us who perhaps have not participated as much in InfoCard will see that it has mass, now speaking for Oracle, will see that it has mass, or will anticipate that it has mass, and will do something about that, because if you don't, you'll get left out. So, you know, that's what drives this at the end of the day, market requirements. Now that was an enterprise statement. The thing that's a little bit more nebulous to me is, how does that play with the people, right, with the users, when we talk about user centricity? Because that to me is a much more amorphous world that is not quite so clear. An enterprise customer will vote with a purchase order. I'm not sure how that's evolving yet with
well,
users.
I totally agree that the communication level between me and my friends at we can call each other friends now, right? See, at Liberty and. I'm a tremendous admirer of Liberty.
Is that on the record, too?
I'm a tremendous admirer of the work they've done. They were pioneers. They did great work around understanding the use cases and the policy and everything else. I've learned a lot from Liberty. I want everybody who's been involved in Liberty to be, you know, congratulated and furthered in their work, because they, you know, everything that builds identity is, in my view, good. No, I'm totally serious. And now the thing is, are we going to come together closer? Yes. I mean, we're working on this. We're talking about this. The other thing is, they aren't, the technologies that the Liberty guys and ladies developed are not in any way opposed to the ones that are in the information card. They're, you know, orthogonal. So at the Burton Group conference last week, there was a demonstration of a system where you use your info card in order to log into a site, which then gives you Liberty interconnectivity to all these, something like 20 different sites. I mean, that were themselves in a circle of trust. So, you know, that's what we need, is not to, you know, and I find it so discouraging that the industry is always, or the journalists and the analysts and so on are always saying, and I don't blame them, I mean, everybody has to make a living, but, you know, how do these things go against each other when the truth is they actually fit together pretty well?
I think, oh, Rebecca, okay, can I have one last question here? No, it's coming your way, I think. Then we'll go to lunch. Okay.
I was gonna wait till later, but since I got fingered, I work in technology and human rights issues, particularly in places like China, and just in listening to this, just want to put out an appeal when it comes to the whole question of, you know, is this a technology issue or is this a policy issue or what exactly? And the whole issue of, we need to make sure we're not just trying to solve problems in the context of Western democracies, because this technology is going to be used globally and Chinese internet users are quickly going to become the largest body of internet users in the world. A lot of the companies represented here are marketing to that market very aggressively, are going to roll out these products in China. And if we're building technologies that assume legal constraints, policy constraints, that respect individual human rights and respect freedom of speech, we could wind up creating tools that could be used in very unintended ways. And just a general, I guess, word of caution that I hope, as we're thinking about the interplay of law and policy and technology, that we do seek to build tools based on the worst case use scenario in the worst case kind of political environment, and, you know, really try and run through that sort of type of scenario with every tool that gets built to make sure that if this is being used in a place where individual freedoms are not respected and where political and religious speech are considered crimes, how is that going to play out? So just an appeal there. Thanks.
Very good. All right. Thank you. We'll close the session. But before we move for lunch, John wants to give a few announcements here.
Yeah, just to say I'm available for anyone having questions during lunch. I want to make sure everyone feels comfortable enough with the tools that we're creating together here. Also remind you tonight there's this musical mashup, a global musical mashup happening in Cambridge at the Middle East, which is a club not too far. Then tomorrow we'll be back here, and then tomorrow night at MIT Media Lab is where we're going to do this identity mashup. And then remember, Wednesday is a day in open space. So we're going to shift from this kind of panel model, even with the mashed up questions, to actually being able to convene sessions that everybody chooses to propose as a group. So we've got a lot coming. And I'm here, and others, if you need any help.
All right. So we'll convene at 2:00 back here.